Welcome to The Hidden World of Women, a podcast brought to you by Women's Health and Wellbeing Services. My name is Emma and I'll be your host for today's episode.
Today I'm joined by an absolutely fantastic woman. You may know her as Melanie Robson. She was the first host of Hidden World of Women podcast. She is now here as Melanie Brown. So Melanie is, she loves weight training. She loves spending time with her dogs and spending time out in nature, as well as eating out and spending time with her family. Obviously, in between the time when Mel was hosting the podcast and now, Melanie has got married, which is why she's now Melanie Brown. And she's here today dressed in her wedding dress to celebrate Froctober. Thanks so much. It's so great to see you again, Melanie.
Thanks, Emma. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be able to wear my wedding dress.
Yes.
More than once.
And it's fantastic to get to see you in your wedding dress because you got married in the middle of COVID and all of the stress that was around it. So
bit of a nightmare.
It was, but I get to see you in it, so I'm super excited. And it's gorgeous.
Squished myself back into it.
It's all right. It's just, it's the joy that's just exuding from you. That's
Lovely. Thank you.
So we're here to tell me, what is Froctober?
Okay. Froctober, a month-long event that occurs in the month of October, where it's run by the Ovarian Cancer Research Foundation, so the OCRF. They're based over in Melbourne, I believe. Could be Sydney. It's not Perth.
It's not Perth.
Not Perth. We just call it Over East.
Yeah, perfect.
Where you frock up, so you wear a dress. Anyone, doesn't, you don't have to be
regardless of gender.
Yep. To raise awareness and funds for ovarian cancer research. Yeah, so you can do, like what I'm doing is uploading a picture of myself in my wedding dress doing crazy stuff every day, but you can host a little quiz at work. I've done that here before a few years ago. And it's kind of anything really that you want it to be, but the goal is really to increase awareness, because there's still not a lot of awareness about ovarian cancer, but primarily fundraising. Unfortunately, that's at the core of, as you would know, being non-profit.
And the reality is that if we don't raise funds, then obviously raising awareness isn't very helpful, because now you know about it, but there's no funds for it to be able to do anything about it.
Yeah, which is so, even more frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you happy to share why you got started in Froctober?
Love to. I'd got started because a friend of mine 5 years ago now, called Tam, she had changed her name to Ocean, which is just the most perfect thing for her. She died from ovarian cancer. She was 41 and she had a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old, which is just extremely tragic, obviously. And she was diagnosed at stage 4, which is actually very common, which is the reason why so much more funding and research is needed. So stage 4, obviously, most people would know that's already well advanced, metastatic and terminal. And so she lived for less than 6 months after her diagnosis, and it was horrific. There's no other word for it. It was traumatic. It was devastating for her family, as well as her friends, everyone, her children as well, who she didn't get to see grow up. So since then, because I was pretty clueless. She was clueless too. You know, we kind of all know about breast cancer and cervical this and that.
Look, I kind of know about ovarian cancer, and obviously more because of your experiences with it.
Yeah.
But even now, it's still something that we don't really talk about. And like you say, there's a lot of awareness that's raised for cervical cancer or breast cancer, testicular cancer.
That's right.
Prostate cancer.
True.
But very little in the way of, you know, how do you test for it? And that's obviously one of the big issues.
Yeah. So there's no early detection test for ovarian cancer, unlike breast cancer, mammogram, cervical cancer, pap smear, but we now have the
self-screening.
Self-screening and a vaccine and all these things.
HPV.
Yes. I really should know that. but ovarian cancer often isn't diagnosed until it's advanced, because there's no early detection test and the symptoms are usually really vague.
So I've got a kind of vague memory of that time.
Yes.
And Tam, she, so you went with her to the hospital and so she was experiencing some abdominal issues.
Yes.
But kind of no idea that this is what this was going to be. So can you tell me a little bit about her story?
Yeah, sure. So she'd gone through a very difficult time generally. She'd recently was in the process of getting divorced. she'd lost her job, she'd become a single mother, she was under huge amounts of stress, and she'd turned 40. So she was usually very slim and she'd gained some weight. But, you know, when you think about all these things, you just think, well, and her diet was bad because she was so stressed. So
but so I'm 41.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I have some health conditions.
Yeah.
But when I go to the doctor,
yeah,
the response is, that's what happens when you turn 40.
That's it. Yeah.
And it really is dismissed.
Yeah.
So, or, you know, any kind of issues that you're having, you probably need to lose some weight.
Yeah. All that old chestnut.
So, you know, either it's because you're overweight or because you're a woman of a certain age.
Yeah.
And so everything gets dismissed.
Yeah, you know,
either we do that to ourselves or our professionals do it.
True, that kind of medical gaslighting thing that goes on, particularly for women. Mm. I believe she'd had some symptoms, I think some bowel symptoms, I don't know 100%, and she did go and, I think, get some things checked out. But what happened that week leading up to me dropping her at hospital, she'd gone to hospital the week or two before, and they'd said, oh, you're probably constipated or something like this. She's like, oh, okay. Went home, I don't know, did the things or whatever and didn't really help. What she was also experienced, because it was advanced, I'll just say that. I'll also say I'm not a doctor.
Yeah.
So just that caveat there. Because it was quite advanced, her lungs were filling with fluid from something called ascites, I think is how you say it, which is fluid produced by cancer. So it's sort of cancerous cells. So hence the kind of weight gain from the tumour itself, but also general weight gain because it was a lot of fluid in her body from all the cells. So she went back to hospital. She rang me that morning and was in a lot of distress and couldn't breathe properly. And I was like, you don't have asthma. She's like, I don't have asthma. Kids were bouncing off the walls. So I called in sick here. I'm like, I can't come in, bye, kind of thing. And went there and she'd taken some painkillers at that point because if you think about the pressure in the body, in the lungs, and we chuffed the kids off to school and daycare. We went and even got it. We picked up like a Macca's coffee. It was ridiculous when I look back on it, but she was kind of feeling a bit better because she'd taken some painkillers. And I dropped her.
Sometimes just having somebody with you.
Well, that's it. Yeah. You
know, like there's that fear of what if I die and I'm alone with my children? But as soon as you've got somebody who's with you, kind of some of the stress goes away and you do start to feel a little bit better.
Yes, and her family don't live in Perth. Mm. They live in the country and over east. So she was quite alone. So I dropped her at hospital. I still regret to this day not going in with her, but I sort of went back to her house and tidied up. I was like, oh, I'll do that. But honestly, nobody expects, you know, to drop someone off and then they basically don't come home for weeks on end because they've found something. So then, because she went back so soon and was still really suffering, then they did some very serious investigations, which was internal ultrasound. And she was texting me and later she said, you know, the technician, I think it was a male technician doing that, she was chatting away to him and he was chatty and she just said the look on his face just changed and she was like, ooh.
I feel like I should panic now.
Yeah, and of course, as it goes, you know, they can't say anything.
Yeah.
So she had further investigation. She had a blood test and a cancer marker for ovarian cancer was very high. It's called CA125. I believe it was off the charts. We later kind of found that out. The problem also with ovarian cancer is that it's tricky to diagnose. So there is not having that early detection kind of test. You can't just do a blood test or a scan. Mm. The only way to definitively diagnose it is through surgery, sort of a biopsy. So this was around Easter. And so she was admitted to hospital. We had to persuade her ex, I'm not rolling my eyes, to come and get the kids and take care of them because she was very ill, you know, at that point and had to have a drain in her lungs, all this kinds of stuff, and query ovarian cancer. And me and another friend, we're still good friends, Tanya, she went to high school with Tam. Mm. We just kind of knew. We just knew it was, I don't know, you know, that feeling where you're like, this is very bad. And it took a while to get a formal diagnosis because it was Easter and doctors were in the public hospital, which were great, but, you know, there was just a delay there and it took a while for the formal diagnosis and it was the worst kind of thing. You know, and of course if it had been found a bit earlier, maybe there would have been more chance for her to have, more time.
Mm.
If you diagnose it like, I was just reading my notes before, like stage 1A or 1B, it's almost classed as curable because they can really get in there. It hasn't spread, you know, it's contained. They can do surgery. I don't know if they do chemo at that stage, I'm not sure. But that's very, very unusual that it's found at that point. So
what's the difference between 1A and 1B, do you know?
I didn't know that there
was a stage 1A and 1B. I just thought it was stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, stage 4.
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know what the difference is, but they just said 1A, 1B. So I think with Tam, she was diagnosed at like 4A or something. So even within the stages, there's subcategories.
Yeah, there's stages.
That's a good question, though. Mm. Yeah, I don't know. But it's like overwhelmingly, I think it's like 50% of women are diagnosed at advanced, when they're advanced. Oh, yeah, if found in stage 1A or 1B, 5-year survival rate is 92%. However, only 19% of cases are found that early.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And generally, from what I understand, they're found by accident.
Yeah.
So women are going in to have, you know, they might be going in to have a hysterectomy or, you know, going in for something else. While they're in there, they go, oh, we've just noticed this.
Oh, we've just found this. Yeah, because the symptoms, I'll go through the signs and symptoms, are very vague, like I said. And as women, we have a lot of damn symptoms down there.
Yes. And I was going to say that while these are the symptoms, you know, we do encourage people to go and talk to their doctors.
Absolutely.
If you have these symptoms, it doesn't mean that you have ovarian cancer.
No. So, gosh, no.
They are quite broad symptoms.
Yes.
Yeah.
And ovarian cancer is still classified as a rare cancer, but it's the most lethal reproductive cancer.
Yeah.
Because it's not found.
How rare is it?
Well, something like 1 in 76 or something like that, women, 1 in 76 women are at risk of developing ovarian cancer in their lifetime. That is slightly, I think that's women with no risk factors. So risk factors would include like the BRCA 1 or 2 genes, where it's like a 15 to 20% increased chance, because those genes are tumour suppressor genes. So obviously if that's faulty, it's not suppressing. I think we normally have, you know, our body's fighting off little things all the time, which would be tumours and stuff like that. And it just does its job.
Mm.
Yeah, so if you don't have that,
then it can't do its job if it's not there.
So 1 in 176 is, so it's very low. But the thing is, if
that sounds a lot, Mel.
It does.
Don't you think?
In a room full of women.
You know, like, I ran an event last weekend. We had 100 men in the room. So that's
one and a bit
men.
Something.
I mean, obviously men are not going to get ovarian cancer and I'm very aware of that. But, you know, I'm just thinking about the people who are in that room. Yeah. 1 in 76, that sounds... I was thinking, is it like 1 in 4,000?
No, it's not. Yeah, so...
Wow.
But I guess on this, I don't know, on the scale of other reproductive cancers.
Yeah. Well, that's it. What is it? I mean, it's much higher for breast cancer.
And cervical, although that's significantly changing now, certainly for the younger population. And over 70% of ovarian cancers are actually start in the fallopian tubes.
Ah.
So I think they never used to know that until research, of course.
Yeah.
So if you have, say, an increased risk, maybe you have the genetic, the BRCA1, you're positive for those genes, you would need to get genetic testing for that. Yeah. You can have your fallopian tubes out to dramatically decrease your chances. Mm. Otherwise, it does start in the ovaries or the peritoneum, which is like the fluid that surrounds all the abdominal, you know, the abdominal cavity. There's just fluid in there to stop stop your organs sticking together.
Ah.
So it can, I believe it can start in there, but it's very, very rare. But wherever it starts, if it becomes advanced, it'll spread there. Yeah. And once it's in the fluid, we know what fluid moves everywhere.
Moves everywhere.
And then it spreads. Yeah.
So, the symptoms.
Symptoms. So, abdominal pain or pressure.
Yep.
A feeling of abdominal fullness. So that's, how do you discern that from, I guess with a lot of these symptoms, if they're new for you, if they're unusual, if they're persistent.
Yeah.
Yep. Abdominal swelling, bloating, sudden weight changes. So that could be either
increase or decrease.
Yeah. Persistent changes in bowel or bladder habits. So you might be going to the loo, might be weeing a lot more. Urinary frequency can happen. Lower backache or cramps. Abnormal vaginal bleeding. So that's quite rare. That's not usually associated with ovarian cancer, but it is with one of the very rare ovarian cancer types, usually in younger women, I believe. pain during sex. And as a tumour, if you've got a tumour and it grows within that peritoneal cavity, the symptoms produced are abdominal pain and that bloating, and may be confused with other bowel issues.
Yeah.
You know, irritable bowel, or if you have endometriosis, there is a bit of a crossover, or a lot of crossover between endo symptoms and ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
Or if you've got cysts, you know, or PCOS, you just have bad freaking periods. Mm. I don't know, you've got a fructose intolerance.
That's exactly it. Yeah. You eat some grainy bread.
That's it. There is, and I think as women, we're conditioned to sort of dismiss pain because we're very used to it. You know, it's part of our biology almost.
Yeah.
So how do you know what's normal and what's not, you know, which is the million-dollar question.
And how do you get people to take you seriously?
Yes, you keep trying. You go back to, you find another doctor. Yeah, I know you know this and say this all the time, but it's the most important thing for women to be taken seriously. And, yeah, you got to keep trying. It's really hard because I think, you know, listening to yourself and trusting yourself, obviously for every single human being, so important. But when we're talking about something like this, and you often, you know, often I read just random articles and people are like, I knew something was wrong, whether that's ovarian cancer or something else. And you've just got to fight your way through. Who cares if they think you're hysterical or if you're overreacting? Who cares?
Yeah,
you keep going until you get an answer.
And trust your gut, you know, and
definitely
be your own expert and your own advocate. So, and as you say, who cares? Like I had one doctor told me I was a neurotic mother.
Oh God.
And then another doctor told me I had Munchausen by proxy. Ooh. And yeah, I know. But kept going until, because I knew there was something.
Yeah.
And wow. You know, and there was, and we got to the bottom of it. And
I think that's a classic example.
Yeah. But that took four doctors
to
go to before somebody would actually listen. And that's why we just, sometimes it does feel like you're banging your head against a brick wall, but at the same time, if you don't,
maybe a bit too late. And of course, I was just thinking too then of endometriosis, you know, how long, years and years before women get a diagnosis. That may be changing now. I think there's a lot more awareness.
Yeah.
But typically,
it's
not funny. It's so bizarre. You've got to laugh because how can this be real in 2023, but it still is.
But I mean, how many doctors still think fibromyalgia is what we call is the new name for neurotic women?
Wow, it's so insulting, isn't
it? Yeah. So I guess I just wanted to acknowledge that it can be difficult when you're trying trying to access medical help. And especially because some of these symptoms are really, like you say, how many women experience bloating?
Absolutely.
Abdominal pressure and,
you
know, discomfort and pain.
Yep.
A lot.
Yeah. You know.
Certainly a lot more than one in 76.
Yes. Yeah. So, yes, if they're really different for you and very and persistent and not in a cyclic way, if they're cyclic, well, it's probably to do with your menstrual cycle and whatnot. But
I guess what I meant is that it's really easy for people to dismiss you because – those are just normal things that women experience.
So
you spoke about a blood test that Tam had.
Yes.
So the markers were off the charts.
Yes.
Is that something that women can go and ask for that blood test? Do you know? I mean, I know you're not a doctor. I just wondered if you might know.
I believe you can. I suspect they would say no. Like, why do you want that? The CA125, they use that also to look at endometriosis and how your body's responding to that, which I didn't know until recently. I mean, I guess you could ask. Hmm. You could ask. You could find a doctor who's willing to do that for you. They'd probably ask you a ton of questions.
Yeah.
What your risk factors are and why you think that's true. You know, you might find someone.
It's worth asking.
It's totally worth asking. I don't see why you wouldn't, because there's, you know, other blood tests all the time that people can. There is, with endometriosis, there is a very slight increase of developing ovarian cancer if you have endo. I was just reading about this recently because there's a lot of crossover there. It's a growth. It's very similar symptoms, but it's very slight, so it's not much. And there's a slight increased risk of developing like epithelial cancer or cancer of the lining of the uterus or something with endometriosis. But that's a whole kind of separate thing. go and ask your doctor. Really? Yeah, yeah. I think with that CA 121, 125 in risk. Yes, so it's like that 1 in 76. If you have endometriosis, that can increase to 1 in 55.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Mm. They say that's slight. They call that statistically a very slight increase. So I don't know. I don't understand.
Oh. There are a lot of women in Australia. Yeah, you know?
I know.
That's, yeah. Yeah. But I guess it's all relative.
It's all relative. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a whole article here about is there a connection between ovarian cancer? And I could put these up in show notes.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The mainly endo obviously is like a chronic disease, chronic condition that's not cancerous, and obviously ovarian cancer is, but there's a lot of a crossover. And they're trying to work that out in terms of research, which would be funding.
Yeah. So this is your fifth year of Froctober.
Probably fourth. I don't think I sort of vaguely did it last year. The year before that, I did every day, but with general photos, and got my now husband to take photos and also be in a dress. That was really funny. Yeah, so I do it on and off because I just tend to go hard with it, which is quite emotionally and physically quite exhausting. Yeah. But I just want to, you know, attract as much attention, basically, so it can be talked about and people can donate money because, you know, as we know with the whole money thing we were talking about before, but I think around in the 1990s, the survival rates for breast cancer, ovarian cancer, and I believe prostate cancer were about the same. That's the same, which weren't great. You know, kind of thing. And of course now breast and prostate cancer way different now. Yeah. Early detection, screening, all this stuff. And the biggest difference is funding. They just got a lot.
A lot
of funding, and with ovarian cancer too, with treatments, it's still a very one size fits all approach. So there's not this kind of individualized treatment options that I believe exist for other cancers. I'm not 100% with that. So
it's interesting, like, why is that?
Yeah,
you know, why do we end up? Because I had a similar conversation with Kath Mazzella a couple of weeks ago, when she was speaking about vulva cancer, and same thing. There's even less awareness for that. There's no month for that.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
You know, I wonder why breast cancer and cervical cancer and prostate cancer have been. You know, what was it that shone a light on them that hasn't been shone in other areas?
Yeah, so. I would wonder if it's. Just the more people,
more prevalent,
and then of course when tragically, of course, you know, people who are well known or famous develop it, and then they can really champion the cause, and that's got a lot of weight to it.
Yeah,
that really does.
Certainly, I guess we saw Olivia Newton-John and McGrath Foundation.
So we can just reel these names. Yeah, off
exactly.
Yeah, that's how.
Whereas when you think about, I mean, ovarian cancer, I. Talk about Ocean or Noreen. Those are the only two people who I know.
Noreen, so, I remember her.
Yeah. And her, so...
do you know,
Noreen's cancer was found, that was one of the ones that was found accidentally. So they were in removing something else and found it. So wow. And so hers was in her fallopian tubes as well. And she's lost her battle with that as well. So, but she did actually... survive for, I think, because hers was found by accident.
Right.
So she survived a lot longer.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, really, those are the only two people who I can think of, and that's because of a personal connection.
Yep.
I can't think of anyone famous that we've heard of. So, and there will be them out there.
Yeah, I can't think of anyone.
But their names
don't kind of spring to mind. Yeah.
Yeah. So with doing this for how many years, what have you found? Like, so you not only share photos, you share. The information, like kind of the information that comes out from the Froctober campaign.
Yep.
Have there been any of those like kind of bits of information that you found really interesting or really surprising or things that you didn't know? Well, I suppose most of it you didn't know the first year.
Most of it I didn't know. I found that what I just mentioned before about ovarian cancer prognosis and that being on par with breast and prostate in the 90s, that shocked me. I just couldn't believe that. And it's solely funding, which funds research.
Yeah.
So research. That really surprised me. There is some latest research, let me find it here, about a blood test that is being being developed. It's called the Clio Triage Test, I think. Clio Triage Test. And so the Ovarian Cancer Research Foundation has been funding this research regarding this blood test over 12 years. I'm just going to read here, has moved from the laboratory into the product development and commercialization phase from August 2023. So the new ovarian cancer surgical triage test was developed at the Hudson Institute of Medical Research in Melbourne by Professor Andrew Stevens and his team to improve ovarian cancer diagnosis with the potential to reduce unnecessary surgery, leading to obviously better outcomes, saving time and resources. So currently, as I've mentioned, as part of the clinical workflow, most patients will have a combination blood test for CA125 and an ultrasound to screen for a mass in the pelvic area, which I mentioned before. Neither method is sufficient for accurate diagnosis and people need surgery. The Clio Triage Test is being developed as an easy-to-administer blood test that can distinguish between benign and malignant disease accurately prior to surgical intervention, because you can have growths.
Yeah.
You know, benign things happen all the time.
Yeah.
But it's like which one's benign and which one's malignant. So they can develop a more accurate blood test right off the bat. There's less need for invasive surgeries and stuff like that. What are they saying here? The potential benefits: improved early evaluation of patients using a simple blood test that provides actual cancer diagnostic assessment before surgery, and high specificity and sensitivity to identify cancers, allowing efficient referral of patients to an appropriate gynecological oncology surgeon for treatment. So that's really exciting.
I was going to say that's really, I was like, is exciting the right word? Because I was going to say the same thing. But yes,
it's a research development, and that's exciting in the field.
Especially because it means that women are potentially avoiding unnecessary surgery.
Absolutely.
But also, I imagine it's a lot less stress for everybody involved to have a blood test rather than to have surgery as well. So, and also the resources for the hospitals and all of that stuff.
Yeah. So. Oh, for sure. There's a lot of energy, money, resources into all of that. Yeah, and they do say here exactly what you're sort of saying, substantial reduction in stress and anxiety experienced by women who undergo a cancer scare.
Yeah.
And must wait for surgical diagnosis, which is exactly what what happened with Tam. And I can't imagine what it was like for her. I mean, I witnessed it. But for us on the outside too, it was a roller coaster. It was horrendous. Yeah. Just what's going on? Why can't they get in there? Why can't they tell us? Like,
because I remember that you were waiting for that surgery and it just like everything's hanging.
Yep.
Not knowing. Yep. And not knowing, I actually think is worse.
Yeah.
Saying that, obviously, she had a terrible prognosis, so maybe it wasn't worse.
Yeah.
But, it was such a long time to have to wait.
Mm. Yes.
And,
it's agonising. Like I was saying before, I think we all kind of knew. I think that the doctors would have known, but, there's protocols and ways to do these things. But the sooner you know, the sooner you can get on with, what am I going to do about this?
Yeah.
What does this mean for me? What does this mean for my family? And hopefully have more time to work that out. A few months is not a lot of time to come to terms with the fact that you're dying.
Yeah.
And you're leaving young children behind and life's a mess and you don't get a chance to resolve it. I mean, that's, and there was really good services that helped her. They did, I can't remember what service it was that visited her home. She had a hospital bed at home, all these things, oxygen tanks, all that kind of stuff. But they came out and helped to make boxes for her children to leave behind. And I don't think she quite grasped. You can't. I just, so it's great that was done. Really, really good, in hindsight. I remember too, I think that another problem with ovarian cancer is she was having she was in the cancer ward at Sir Charles Gardner Hospital for a while, which is massive. I'd never been there. It's like an entire floor. It's very confronting.
Yeah.
And she was in a shared room and, they're never fun. I'm sure we've all been to hospital. It's just a bit of a nightmare generally. And she was aware that there was, on another level, there was a whole ward dedicated to breast cancer patients. So they had their own special thing, which beautiful, wonderful, And it was really upsetting for her and for us that she had a reproductive cancer as well.
Yeah.
Only happens in women, obviously, or anyone with ovaries. And yet she was sort of chucked in there with everyone else and she had to fight to get her voice heard. It was really, it was awful kind of things.
So. I often find that with breast cancer as well, that breast cancer ward is... It's very feminine. It's very it's very soft. It's very...
Yes, that's it.
You know, there's lots of soft furnishings and lots of additional... niceties aren't the right word, but you know what I mean. But then the other ward, it's harsh. It's clinical. It seems to have harsher lighting and curtain, like, you know, just the curtains. And, you've got... Sometimes you've got men and women in the same ward.
She did. And that's exactly it. There's a really stark difference.
Yeah, and so it goes from you've got this really gentle, nurturing space to a sterile clinical space. But I also imagine it would be very confronting for somebody at the... I know that she wasn't at the beginning of a cancer journey because it was already stage four. But she was at the beginning of her cancer journey.
Yes.
To be confronted by...
Yes.
People who are, you know... bald and dying.
Absolutely. All of that.
Yeah.
You know, and crap in the bed and vomiting and just, there's kind of no words for that. But exactly, she was at a different point. I remember they had a psychologist at the hospitals that come in, help people adjust. if you can.
Good luck with that,
without much time to do that. But, yeah, it was, I remember once she said, She kept ringing the buzzer. She wanted something was happening for her and she couldn't, nobody was coming. It was very busy, you know.
Yeah.
And she eventually just went out, sat in the hallway and just started crying or yelling or something to get attention, which I assume worked. I think she wanted her own room because of all that. It was very distressing and there was different genders and ages and it's very unfortunate. I don't know if it's different in private hospitals. This was a public hospital system, which I still think in Australia we've got good healthcare, except very, very good. Very, you know, it didn't cost her anything, all these kinds of things. Yeah. But yeah, it could do better. That's it. And could do better.
Her children haven't been left with a massive debt.
Yep.
So you know, really grateful for that. But just because our bad isn't as bad as somebody else's doesn't make our bad any better.
Yeah, doesn't diminish that. Yeah. She and after she died, they did find that she was positive for one of the BRCA genes. Can't remember if it was one or two, which we now know it's carried along her mother's family line. Yeah, and her, I think it was her grandmother who died from breast cancer. So you know you might have that in the family, but you wouldn't think. Unless you knew, I'm at risk for ovarian cancer as well. And especially, I guess, at her age, you wouldn't really think it either, but women, it's not an old lady's disease. Age and I think menopause and stuff increase your chances slightly.
Yeah.
But actually, too, I learnt recently, this was surprising and a little interesting, that if you've been on the contraceptive pill, that can protect you to a degree, can decrease your chances. I was like... I have mixed feelings about that. Yeah. But I think the genetic stuff, you know, is really important to be aware of. If you've got any family history in blood family, obviously not by marriage kind of thing, we'd encourage you to get checked out.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
And so I suppose for her daughters, that now means
she's got one daughter. Yeah. Or even her son, you know, boys can get breast cancer.
Yeah.
So men, male gender, can get that, but definitely for her daughter.
Yeah,
I believe her mother subsequently went and had some testing and stuff like that, but that's her journey there. But you know, and I think for the family, speaking of her parents, you know, the guilt they felt at not knowing, not realizing this, you really kind of learn these things after the fact and like, had we known. But why would you know? Why would you think to... It's kind of only now, even 5 years down the track, that people are way more aware of stuff like that. You can send off I've done that, you know, certain websites and get your DNA on your ancestry and all this and genetic, you know, all this stuff. But that's just, wasn't such a thing even 5-6 years ago.
No, but also a lot of... where I'm from, reproductive cancers wouldn't be spoken about.
So it's like sort of shame and taboo.
Yeah, or you just don't talk about those. You don't talk about women's bits.
Yeah.
And, you know, women's problems and those types of things. Mm-hmm. So So for some families, they might not know that those that they have that family history because it was just just kind of pushed in the dark corner and shame left to fester type of thing.
Well,
so
silence. I think silence is a killer, literally.
Yeah. And I suppose that's one of the reasons why I like doing the podcast because I think, you know, shame lives in the dark. So let's shine the light on it and let's there should not be any shame or stigma around speaking about breast cancer, ovarian cancer, cervical cancer, vulva cancer, you know, anything.
Yeah.
So we really need to make it so that people can talk about it, raise awareness.
Yeah.
And then hopefully we can get a little bit more awareness, which also will bring some more funding. Because while it's great that I think that people like yourself are doing things to try and raise money.
Yes, it's not much money in the scheme of things.
No. Wouldn't it be amazing if that money came from health?
Yeah, government. I know that the OCRF gets most of their a lot of their funding from government, but then private enterprise fundraising, all that stuff as well.
Yeah.
I think they've been around since 2000, you know, and slowly kind of making themselves
more
known. But, it comes down to the dollar, which is so bizarre. I just find that I can't.
I know.
You know, and then you hear about sports people who earn,
was it $15 million, $15 million or $15 billion netball?
Oh, right, yeah. You know, like, and let alone in America. It's, it's immoral. But anyway, that's a whole other, I feel very passionate about that.
So we're just going to flip to something a little bit lighter because I feel passionate about it as well and we could soapbox all day.
Totally.
So you're in your wedding dress.
Yeah.
So this for October you are wearing your wedding dress doing...
Yes, doing lots of ridiculous things, some regular things like vacuuming. Yesterday I tried to...
Okay, I don't do that when I'm not in a wedding dress.
No, neither do I. I try not to vacuum at the best of times.
Exactly.
So sort of mundane things through to went beach swimming with the dog and a friend a week ago. That was fun. It was fun. It was cold, but it was fun.
You didn't drown with the weight of the wedding dress?
I didn't wade too far out because it's definitely heavy.
I forget
about that.
It's heavy when it's dry but wet.
Yes! Mm-hmm. You're like, what is this?
Yeah. Also, it doesn't have substantial straps.
No, it doesn't. So I keep falling. I do all these things. What else? You know, car. I washed my car. Yesterday I roller skated. Well, I tried to down the hallway. Borrowed a friend's skates and my son took some photos of me. Pretty funny. It was a lot of fun. You know, I still want to, I had a fire pit with my husband and some cheese and wine. So just, mowing the lawn, had got a photo in me doing that.
Please tell me you were wearing welly boots while you did that.
No.
Oh, shame.
I've got to do one gardening, actually, and put on some boots. I've actually still got some of Tam's boots. It would be perfect
for that.
What else? I've still got to go to the movies. I went to the city yesterday, we were talking earlier, and a friend of mine was running her first marathon, so I was there in my wedding dress going, yay, you know, like, and my I have to drag my husband along to most of these things to take photos. Working out at home, I've got some photos of trying to work out at home in a wedding dress. That's very difficult. But it's just fun. And look, Tam was a very, very bold personality. She was very massive sense of humour. She was very feminine, almost always wore dresses. It was really rare to see her in anything other than a skirt and a dress. She had this beautiful, wild, thick, curly hair, quite eccentric. You know, a lot of people didn't quite know how to take her because she was very extroverted. But this couldn't be a more perfect thing for her, aside from the ovarian cancer thing. But the dresses and the dressing up and having fun and sort of embracing being female and just doing lots of kind of crazy things. I'm hoping to, go to the referendum we've got coming up in my wedding dress and take some photos. I kind of,
That's a tricky one, isn't it?
And I said to my husband the other day, I don't know if I can do it because it just... I'm not naturally, I can be quite bubbly, but it takes a lot of sort of mental energy to put yourself out and people look at you and, ideally you can talk to people about it, but it's quite confronting.
Yeah.
I put petrol in my car the other day in the wedding dress. I was like, I took some photos. I'm like, photo opportunity. But I ran inside and then ran out. It's tricky at times, but then I think of why I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And it's a no-brainer. Yeah. It's a total no-brainer. So, and I get to use my wedding dress all the time.
Yeah, that's it. I remember when I got married, somebody saying to me, if I was getting married, I'd be, I'd wear that dress every day for, however long and, I'd run marathons in it type of thing. And
good luck.
Yeah, I know, exactly. I mean, I can't run marathons in sports gear. Certainly couldn't do it in a wedding dress. But that's exactly what you're doing. You're wearing it every day.
Yeah. Yeah. So. It's, and I did think about doing this last year, but I knew it would be quite a bit of work, so I didn't do it. But I just thought I've got the dress there. Because last time when I did it, I just was going to op shops and buying lots of different dresses.
Yeah.
I do have quite a few dresses. I need to get a lot. And it was a lot of work. And I'm like, wait, I've got married recently. I can use my wedding dress. So
sweet.
That's so good. And it's machine washable too, this dress. So I just chuck it in.
Amazing.
I don't know how I did that, but I managed to get a dress that's machine washable.
So what has the reaction? So obviously you've come into the office today wearing a wedding dress, and there's like random strangers in Gosnells who are kind of looking at you a little strange.
People just, I went out to lunch with a friend last week in Vic Park. That was fun. People look, but not many people will say anything.
Oh, wow.
If they do, it's usually women who are like, that's a nice dress. You can see them going, is that your wedding dress? It's interesting. Not a lot of people ask sort of why. I don't know. Maybe they think I'm just a bit odd kind of thing. But
you're just somebody who wants to get her money's worth.
That's it. Don't we all? Yeah. They're not cheap. So not as much, as I kind of thought. I don't know. Yeah, it's.
Yeah.
Maybe if I was more, I do think about this, like maybe if I was a bit more, hey, you know, like kind of a bit more like Tam, who would just talk to anyone, like she's super chatty and da 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 da.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it sort of, that takes a bit more sort of mental effort or psychological effort to kind of, yeah. But I got some little postcards made up using some graphics from the Ovarian Cancer Research Foundation, with their permission, with the symptoms on one side and what Froctober is, and then a QR code so they can donate to my campaign if they want to. I haven't given out too many of them. It just depends where I am.
Yeah. But at least you've got them. So if anybody does ask, you can go, oh, here's something I prepared earlier.
Because I can like blush as well. So I'm like, oh, my God. You know, then the whole thing starts happening. But if I just remember why I'm doing it, maybe have a glass of champagne. You know, if my husband's there, I'm like, okay, you know, I can just do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how is it? So you're doing this for a whole heap of reasons, but one of them is obviously as a way to honour Tam.
Yeah.
How is that?
Honouring Tam?
Yeah, like how does that impact you with knowing Froctober's coming up and
good question.
Remembering her and all of those things?
I suppose it's emotional. You know, it's probably a little less than it was 5 years out. I send the pictures to her mum. Her mum's also a very bright personality.
Yeah.
And I guess on some level for me it just helps me stay connected to her.
Yeah.
I remember having... Oh, it's going to make me sad. Conversations with her towards the end of her life. And she was terrified and like worried that no one would remember her, which is, I just think, it just makes me laugh because I'm like, Tam, you're the most unforgettable person. She really was. She was not that quiet mouth. So this is a way to remember her.
Yeah.
I'm also mindful though that she doesn't want to be, I'm sure she wouldn't want
to. She was more than just ovarian cancer.
Absolutely. Yeah. So much more. Yeah. You know, she was a mad animal lover and campaigner and stuff like that. And she worked for child protection. Mm. She had a psych degree despite having dyslexia and ADHD. She'd been bullied a lot in school before she got her diagnosis. So she had a really tough life.
Mm.
And really had to fight her way through. She was very bright, but that, you know, that wasn't seen, I think, because of, It's a little different now, but, you know, sort of. We're kind of making our way towards that. So it just was even more tragic, I think, and particularly when her marriage broke down because she loved love and romance and the whole thing. She was just a huge romantic, huge-hearted kind of woman. So... I don't know, you know, I kind of hope she's watching and I just try to channel her sometimes and it helps me remember her and in a different way than, say, going to the cemetery, you know, because that's not her, you know, she's not there. Well, if she isn't, she isn't. But I don't know if I'd want that, you know, when I'm gone, it's more doing things that remind you of them.
But going out swimming in the ocean in a wedding dress is 100% a way to honour who she was.
Who she was, you know, I remember once... she'd bring her kids over and we'd hang out when they were quite little. And once for dinner, we just had fairy bread because we were just like, fuck it, let's just have fairy bread with the kids. And she's just that kind of person that you could do that stuff with. So, yeah, it's good. It's, yes, it's a bit challenging, but it's, yeah, it helps me remember her. And her friend Tanya came over the other day, who knew her from high school, and I convinced her to get in her wedding dress. She got married 16 years ago.
And it still fits.
No, I mean, just like we managed to squeeze her in a bit, but she, you know, and she was, I think that's another thing too. It's quite, it's if you, you know, if you don't feel good in your body, it's quite challenging to be out there and stuff. So she was, you know, I grapple with that. I think a lot of people do. But I sort of said, we're not going to see you from the back. Like I said, I've had to adjust mine. I've had to sew in other things because like it's, I don't fit into it anymore. And that was only, I don't know, I got married like a couple of years ago or something. Two, three, I can't remember.
You should know this.
I should know. 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Just so busy. So she came over. We took some photos.
Yeah.
And then my husband had the idea to, he was working on a, he's got some cars that he works on. And so he's like, why don't I put like a mat down and you guys lie under the car, look like you're working on the car. So we did that. It looks so funny because we've got tools and looks like we're not, with these long wedding dresses on. So that was really good that Tanya came over and we did that. And we always talk about her. We always talk about her when we're together. Yeah, it was, we were very lucky to have each other through Tam's journey because it would have been far worse not having, because we were just talking every day. And talking to Tam.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you really need someone when you're supporting someone else through that.
Yeah. Yeah, actually that's a really good point that when you are, often women are the support people.
Yeah.
So.
Absolutely.
And even if.
The carers.
Even if she had been married, chances are it's still the women who are the support people. It's still the women who hold that. And a previous episode I was speaking to Rochelle who she was speaking about her breast cancer journey and kind of saying the same thing. All of her women rallied around her and they arranged shifts for who was going to take her to the different oncology appointments or the radiation appointments or those types of things. It's the women who circle. And, you know, I often say when women circle, great things happen.
Yeah, so true.
But it's women who are left with the weight of it.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, but you wouldn't not do it.
Oh, no, most definitely not. Yeah. I guess I'm just thinking for if you are on the journey with somebody who's experiencing some kind of cancer, what are your learnings for how to look after yourself while you're there to support other people?
Oh, you've definitely got to have your own little support person or people. Whether that's a good friend or a partner who gets it enough, I'd say, you know, even if they're slightly removed, you know, you may have to, I took days off work. Yeah. I just couldn't, and particularly the type of work I was doing, you know, that was, so I had, you know, but maybe having a
very supportive boss.
Super, super supportive. That's why I stayed so long. But that's genuinely, I mean, that hopefully that a lot of people have that, but I know that they don't. Mm. You know, flexibility in the workplace, I suppose, would be ideal. I guess, too, you have to kind of pace yourself and know what your limit is. And I certainly remember the right at the end when Tam was dying. She'd gone into a coma and she was unconscious for a few nights before she died. And I remember the last night I was there, which was the last night she died, I remember... because I'd been working every day that week and then we'd go and visit her. We knew that that was the end. I remember going home that night going, I need to have a bit of a break. I don't think I can come back tomorrow. And, of course, I got a call at 7 a.m. to say she'd gone. Yeah, so you just, I guess it's sort of knowing your limit, your limits as well and that it's okay to take a break because if your cup is empty, you know, this thing, because it emotionally it can be very tough. It's trauma.
Yeah.
You will be traumatized. Yeah. I just don't think you can't. No. It's traumatic for that person and all the people around them.
Mm.
Yeah. So just being really mindful of that and that it's okay to have a break and, I don't know, send them lasagna instead of seeing them all the time. We would go visit her a lot at hospital and take her out and she hated being in the ward, so we need to go out into the sunshine and stuff like that.
Out into nature and fresh air and as much nature as there is at Charlie Gardner.
There's some, but not much. Even things like that, and just doing things that are not related at all to cancer and to treatment and to the whole, because you're held hostage by that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
you still have a life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you still need to be engaged in your own life.
Yeah.
As well. Otherwise, I think it'll hit you even harder.
Mm. Yeah. yeah. And it's that whole self-compassion thing, isn't it? Self-care and self-compassion. And as you said, you can't pour from an empty cup. And if you're broken, who's going to be there to pick up the pieces?
Especially if you're parenting, you know, often we've got kids and all that stuff as well. Mm. It was really tricky because obviously, but worse for her. But I remember the franticness I felt. I could see it in her.
Yeah.
And I felt that same franticness, and I couldn't think clearly all the time because my brain was like completely overwhelmed with the emotion and the shock of it all. You know, so I suppose too, if you find that that's really happening, you know, get mental health support.
Yeah.
As well, because you can't, you're sort of so far in it and trying to process everything and trying to help. You're just like, what can I do? What can I do? Kind of thing that can get really messy for you, and then you can't be there as much for them. Yeah. So
there is a lot of that kind of scrambling.
There is, especially in the initial stages. I think. I think it's incredibly normal because everyone just presses this panic button.
Yeah. But hospitals are so draining as well.
Oh, my God.
I don't know what it is about them.
They are, hey. But
yeah. So
there's a lot going on there. And there's, like you said before, with the cancer ward, there's bright lights, very clinical. Yeah, very intense, very intense. And they're places of, like, sort of healing, but not
really.
You know,
not.
There's a lot of suffering.
Yeah,
a lot of suffering that goes on there. So,
but even if you remember when you had, like, when you had your baby, and like I remember them coming around, shining a torch on me in the middle of the night, and then so obviously waking up because you're shining a torch on me. Why aren't you asleep? Because you're shining a torch in my face. You know, and that's...
They're not restful places.
They're not restful places. And it's supposed to be a place of healing, but actually they're coming and doing obs every however often. And but, yeah, even when you're not the patient, when you're just there and it's for something almost benign, I still find, you know, if I have to do a hospital visit, I can be wiped out for a couple of days. Yeah. If you're doing that every day for multiple weeks or whatever that is...
It's grueling.
It's a lot.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's interesting though, because I sort of, you know, and then I don't know if other people feel this way, but sometimes I felt guilty for wanting to get the hell out of there, and I could leave that place and go, thank goodness that's not me.
Yeah.
That sounds really, I don't know.
No, I don't think, wrong to be grateful that you're not in that situation.
Yeah. Yeah, and that you could leave and regenerate yourself, but when you're there, where is that? In a place like that, I don't know. There's not even, I don't know if there's on some other levels of hospitals where they have lovely little. The only place I remember that having something like that was when she was in ICU after she had all her surgery. So she had chemo first once they'd worked out what was happening. And they had to give her chemo first to shrink the main tumor. Of course, it had metastasized throughout her body. They had to shrink the tumor before they could get that out. She was desperate to get that out. And honestly, it was like the size of a baby at that point. It was very big. So she had, I think they call it debulking surgery. Mm. So they take out so much, just so much of your abdominal cavity. And she was in ICU, and that was traumatic. I think anyone who's either in there themselves as a patient or have seen family, loved ones, and there's a lot of, I think there's a lot of research now on sort of trauma in hospitals and ICU experiences, but they would wheel her out with all the stuff. It was, it was really impressive with her nurse into this little courtyard, and they'd have PowerPoints out. They'd plug everything back in.
Oh, wow.
It was amazing. Yeah. So well done. That was at Fiona Stanley Hospital. So we could go out there with her. She was not really, she was conscious, but so much pain medication and still an excruciating agony, you know, but we're in the sunshine.
Everything is better when you are outside 100%. In nature, in fresh air and sunshine.
And it's like they knew that there, but I don't know about the other wards. I don't know, because we'd scoot her out. Once I got a call from one of the nurses, because I must have been on her list of, they're like, "Where do you know where Tam is?" I'm like, "Oh, yeah, we're out. We're at the park. We're just hanging out." And like, she needs to come back because they need to do stuff. I was like, "Oh, whatever." You know, at that point, you're like, "Go away. We're just going to do whatever. Whatever she wants to do, we'll do."
We did that with one of my daughter's friends.
Yeah.
We, like, snuck her out.
They don't even even notice half the time.
I went in with one child. I came out with two. No one sort of noticed. And then, yeah, we got a similar conversation and, you know, do you know where she is? Yeah. And it ran through my head, do I lie?
Yeah, I know. It's a fine line.
That's it. I don't want them putting out some kind of pink alert or something. Yeah, I know where she is.
Kidnapper. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But sometimes that's the best medicine, isn't it? Oh, for everybody.
Really is.
Yeah.
It's a real break from the routine, the grueling kind of aspects of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And maybe laughter as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we did a lot of that with, well, she loved to laugh anyway, but it sort of became even more important.
Yeah. And sometimes it's really dark humour.
Oh, yes, because she would – we'd go somewhere or something. She's like, I'm going to whip out the cancer card so we can, like, get in there sooner or get that. I'm like, go for it, Tam. It was so funny. Good. Great. Do whatever you need to do.
Make it work for you, baby.
Why not? Man.
There have got to be some perks.
So that, fun times.
So we weren't sure whether or not we would fill an hour talking about this, and we filled an hour talking about this.
Great.
So before we wrap up, have you got any final thoughts about anything? Was there anything in, I know you've come with, you're very prepared, you've come with a whole heap of notes. Is there anything in there that stuff?
You know, we covered the symptoms and the lack of, the vagueness of them and the need to be very persistent with your healthcare professional, knowing your body, the need for more funding, which funds research. Early detection is just key. It really is. If you get in early with anything, you have far better chance of curing, let alone a long life in managing it. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's just lovely to talk about Tam or Ocean. Yeah. She changed her name after she got divorced, which was fantastic. Yeah.
And so as Melanie's talking, she talks with her hands quite a bit, which I do as well. And so as she's talking about Tam and Ocean, Melanie has a whale tattoo on her arm. And so
whale shark.
The more that you're speaking about her, it's just, you know, you kind of get animated and then this whale shark comes into the conversation as well. So it's really lovely. Speaking about Ocean and then...
She had a whale shark soft toy in her car that she – I saw one in a car recently and I was like, oh, my God. I don't know. I think I was about to start for October. You know when you're like, did I just see that? Do I want to see that? And so I was saying that, but I was like, holy cow. So that was very validating. Like,
It's a sign.
Yeah. I love signs.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Even. Thanks for letting me talk about it so much.
Thank you so much for – yeah, thanks for being here and thanks for sharing so openly. It was so lovely to see you again.
You too.
So Melanie has got some different journal articles. So can put those in the show notes and a link to your Instagram account, which you've got all of your different photos of you doing all of these amazing things.
Yes.
And a link to the fundraising page as well. Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for joining me for today's episode of A Hidden World of Women, a podcast brought to you by Women's Health and Wellbeing Services. For more information on the services we offer, head to whws.org.au or Women's Health and Wellbeing Services on YouTube and social media. Looking forward to the next episode where we uncover the hidden world of women.